Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Neurology Webinar Club. This session today is going to be on common intracranial disease causing blindness. If you follow the webinar club, you may remember that a few months ago, we discussed about the logical clinical approach to a blind animal, and especially trying to find out by combining the result of the MNAS response and the PLR, whether or not the animal has a lesion affecting the retina, the optic nerve, the optic chiasm, or the forebrain. What I'm going to do today is that I've selected three intracranial diseases that we commonly see as causing of blindness. These diseases are cerebrovascular accident, also known as stroke, the meningoencephalitis of unknown etiology, and brain tumor. Starting with the stroke or cerebrovascular accident, there's still a lot of confusion among clinicians, but also in the literature, about the different terminology, cerebrovascular disease, cerebrovascular accident, and stroke. What is cerebrovascular disease? It refers to any abnormality of the brain resulting from a pathological process affecting the cerebral blood vessel. Cerebrovascular accident, also known as stroke, is the clinical manifestation of cerebrovascular disease, which can also have other clinical manifestations. But the stroke is the most clinical manifestation of disease affecting the cerebral blood vessel. What kind of disease can affect the cerebral blood vessel? They are divided in two categories. Simplistically, two things can happen to a blood vessel. The first one is that the vessel can get occluded or the vessel can rupture. Occlusion of a cerebral blood vessel can be due to a thrombus, and you got a beautiful example on this slide on the left of an atheromatous plaque in a dog with severe hypothyroidism, and the artery that got markedly stenotic is a middle cerebral artery. The other cause for vessel occlusion is when a thrombus is formed in an another vascular bed than the cerebral blood vessel. That could be the heart chamber, it could be as well the aorta, and the thrombus will migrate, causing secondary occlusion of a cerebral blood vessel. This is what we call thromboembolism. The second type of pathological process that can affect the cerebral blood vessel is the rupture of a cerebral artery. As I mentioned to you, cerebrovascular accident, also known as stroke, is the most common clinical manifestation of cerebrovascular disease. And already, if you understand the type of pathological process that can affect the blood vessel, you will understand that the clinical manifestation will vary depending if you have an occlusion or vessel rupture. And from now on, we will consider two different types of stroke syndrome. The first one is the ischemic stroke, which is the direct consequence of an occlusion of a blood vessel, while the hemorrhagic stroke is the consequence of a rupture of a cerebral blood vessel. Ischemic stroke is the most common cause of stroke in dog and in human. In human, where stroke are extremely common, while in dog it is fairly uncommon, but the last one I've seen was only yesterday. In human, ischemic stroke represents two-thirds of symptomatic stroke, while hemorrhagic stroke represents about one-third. What's happened with an ischemic stroke and what you need to know about pathophysiology to understand diagnosis, but also treatment? With limited storage capacity, the brain relies on a permanent supply of oxygen and glucose to maintain the ionic pump membrane, which are the sodium-potassium pump membrane. If there is limited supply of blood and therefore oxygen and glucose, the sodium-potassium pump will quickly fail due to this limited storage capacity, and that will result into cytotoxic edema. However, the cells in the brain have different vulnerability to ischemia. The most vulnerable cells are the cell body of a neuron, which are located in the gray matter, While in order of decreased vulnerability, you got after that the oligodendrocyte, the astrocyte, the microglia, and the fibrovascular element. Why you need to know that is that from an imaging point of view, when you're trying to diagnose ischemic stroke, one of the characteristics is that the changes, which are reflecting by the cytotoxic edema, are particularly pronounced in the gray matter due to this selected vulnerability. How do we classify ischemic stroke? They are classified with a number of criteria. The first one is which region of the brain is involved, and we define, for example, cerebellar infarct, or for example, brainstem infarct, or forebrain or cerebrocortical infarct. They also subdivided depending on the vascular territory and the type of vessel involved. Each arteries, major artery of the brain, provide blood supply to a very defined region of the brain with very limited collateral supply. So another subclassification is to talk about ischemic stroke depending on which artery territory is involved. For example, rostral cerebellar artery infarction, or striate artery infarction, or middle cerebral artery infarction. The other subclassification is the type of vessel involved. And on this slide, you will see two examples of vessel. The first one is if there is occlusion of one of the main arteries in the brain, for example, the major artery, like the middle cerebral artery or the rostral cerebellar artery, that usually results in a very large infarct called a territorial infarct. While if the occlusion affects one of the deepest and what we call perforating artery, so the one that penetrates the brain parenchyma, this results usually in a small infarct, also known as lacunar infarct. What is the typical clinical presentation of infarct? Any cerebrovascular accident have one thing in common, is the onset and the lack of progression in time. You may remember, if you are familiar with Neurology Club, that we always, when we talk about differential diagnosis, rely on this mnemonic vitamin D in order not to forget any disease process that could be the cause of the sign, but also to try to see with the information provided by the owner in terms of onset and progression of sign, if it's more likely to be one of these disease processes. And vascular disease, whether or not it's ischemic or hemorrhagic, have in common the fact that they are usually acute or peracute in onset, and with time they tend to lack progression with a slow regression of sign depending on the severity of the neurological signs. So typically, sudden onset, lack of progression, which is different, for example, with inflammatory or neoplastic disease that tend to get worse with time, or metabolic disease that will wax and wane. There are a type of stroke that we see occasionally in dog, but usually we don't know it is that until the animal will have a proper ischemic stroke. And that is what is known in human as TIA, or transient ischemic attack. A transient ischemic attack is a mini stroke, and by definition, it does not result in structural lesion in the brain. So if you do an MRI, you will see no lesion, and the neurological sign will basically do not last more than 24 hours. So they resolve very, very quickly. As I say, we see it in dog. And it is, in human, a warning sign. If you have a TIA or a suspected TIA, it is usually strongly indicated to look for possible underlying cause, because you will have 1 in 10 chance to develop an ischemic stroke within the next 4 weeks. The other thing that we know, at least in human, about TIA is that they are usually due to embolic disease. So if you had a TIA, they will particularly look at embolic source For example, heart disease or carotid disease as the most common cause for TIA and symptomatic ischemic stroke. Overall, stroke and especially ischemic stroke are not common in dogs. They are far more common in humans. However, a number of conditions in dogs have frequently and are still frequently misdiagnosed for being a stroke. One of the most common ones is idiopathic facial nerve paralysis. Idiopathic facial nerve paralysis is particularly common in dogs, especially in Cocker Spaniel, Cavalier King Charles or Boxer. It's usually characterized by a sudden onset of drooping of the face. And this is something that lead often pet owner, but sometimes as well colleague veterinarian, to think that we're dealing with a stroke. The reason for that is that one of the most common clinical manifestations of a stroke in human is this drooping of the face. However, you may know that from an anatomic and functional point of view, dogs do not use the pyramidal system as motor control, while the human particularly use the pyramidal system. The pyramidal system has its origin in the motor cortex of the brain, in what we call the homunculus. So if you have a lesion in the motor cortex, which is located in the forebrain, very often human will present contralateral drooping of the face, but also contralateral hemiparesis. While in dog, they use the extrapyramidal system, which is mostly the brainstem in terms of motor control and origin of the motor input. And if you got a dog with facial paralysis, it is, in the very large majority of cases, a peripheral neuropathy in terms of location of the problem. And the most common cause in dog would be idiopathic facial nerve paralysis. The second most common cause to think about would be middle ear disease, but not a stroke. The other condition that is frequently misdiagnosed as being stroke in dog is idiopathic peripheral vestibular syndrome. The reason for that is that this idiopathic peripheral vestibular syndrome has usually a per-acute onset of severe loss of balance with head tilt, nystagmus, falling, and that can frequently give the impression that the animal is having a stroke when actually it is, again, a peripheral condition, which we suspect to be a disorder affecting either the vestibular nerve as it travels through the internal acoustic meatus or affecting the receptors of the balance in the inner ear, but certainly not the cause of a stroke. How do we diagnose ischemic stroke? Well, you will need to use advanced imaging to be able to make a diagnosis. CT scan is used in human mostly in most emergency rooms because it is easily accessible in most hospitals in emergency room. It is quick to perform. It is also cheaper. And if you presented with an acute onset of brain signs, they will first of all do a CT scan, mostly to rule out mimic of ischemic stroke. And the mimic would be mostly hemorrhagic stroke, and in that case, a bleed in the brain will be very easily detected with CT, or decompensation from a brain tumor. But in terms of detecting ischemic stroke with CT, it is much more difficult because you may only have very subtle changes which may not be very obvious on most CT. In most cases, the way to diagnose ischemic stroke is basically to do an MRI scan, especially a conventional MRI, and we'll see in a minute what criteria you're going to use. Other diagnostic tests will be to do functional MRI, especially to either be able to diagnose very early ischemic stroke. And in human, it could be very important to do that as the therapeutic window, which is the window of opportunity to give medication for an ischemic stroke, is about 3 to 4 hours. The other indication of functional MRI is to try to visualize the major arteries of the brain and see if there is any occlusion. How reliable is MRI scan to detect ischemic stroke? Well, if you MRI a patient very early on, you may not be able to detect basically any changes or very subtle change. But most of the time, if we basically do within the first 12 to 24 hours, you will start to see the main changes with conventional MRI. And most of the changes rely on the presence of this cytotoxic edema, especially within the gray matter. Remember, in the pathophysiology, the main vulnerability is with the cell body of the neurons, which are located in the gray matter. The other criteria that we use to diagnose ischemic stroke with MRI is that, obviously, when you got an ischemic stroke, you have an occlusion of an artery of the brain. And this artery has some very defined territory. For example, on this slide, you can see a nice example of a lesion that is very well demarcated, mostly affecting the gray matter, minimum mass effect. There is some white matter edema, but it's mostly the gray matter. And this lesion is exactly in the territory of the middle cerebral artery. While this one here on this dorsal T2-weighted scan is affecting the rostral cerebellar artery with a very well-defined gray matter lesion. Finally, what you've got here is a beautiful example of a striate artery infarction. And the striate artery mostly provide blood supply to the caudate nucleus, but also the internal capsule, which is what you find on this beautiful MRI scan. Another criteria, as we've seen, is that you can see very sharp demarcation, and it gives the impression that the lesion has been cut with a knife. And this is not something you will see, for example, with an inflammatory disease or an infectious disease. There is also no mass effect or minimum mass effect, which, you know, help you to differentiate from a neoplastic disease. So criteria are sharp demarcation, vascular territory. This is an example of a rostral cerebellar artery. Here, you got again a sharp demarcation of an infarct in the region of the caudal cerebral artery. As I say, functional MRI can be used to make an early diagnosis of ischemic stroke, and MRI studies such as diffusion or perfusion study help you to detect early on that conventional sequences like T2 or flare, and that will be useful in human in order to detect an ischemic stroke within this therapeutic window of 3 to 4 hours. The other indication of functional MRI is to perform angiography, like you can see there on the dog, in order to see the major artery, and you can see here the internal carotid artery. What do we know about underlying cause of ischemic stroke in dog? Well, until not so long ago, maybe 10 years ago, we had limited information about underlying cause, because ischemic stroke were mostly diagnosed with at postmortem until MRI become more available, and therefore the underlying cause that were identified were often disease that were severe enough to cause the death of the animal. And in that case, obviously give you a skewed perception of possible underlying cause of ischemic stroke. Over 10 years ago, I published a very large study on causes of ischemic stroke and diagnosis of ischemic stroke using MRI that gave us a totally different perception of common causes we see in dog. This is a study that was published 11 years, and I want to draw your attention that we looked at 33 dogs with MRI diagnosis of ischemic stroke, and this dog had a thorough investigation for possible underlying cause. Despite this thorough workup, we only find an underlying cause in just over 50% of dog, which means, and it's exactly the same as in human, there is still half of the dog, despite doing thorough workup, where you don't find underlying cause. Common underlying causes are chronic kidney disease, and a lot of these dogs have protein-losing nephropathy, or hypertension, Cushing, diabetes mellitus, aortic stenosis, and so on. In terms of hypertension, which is frequently seen in dog, in human, well, in dog, we only documented hypertension in 8 out of 28 dog where blood pressure was monitored not only once, but throughout a 24-hour period. So far less common than in human. The criteria to diagnose hypertension are on this slide, and whenever we identified hypertension, there was usually an underlying cause, more commonly chronic kidney disease. Now we are a few years down the line. I managed to recruit 62 cases, and you can see that still we only find underlying cause in half of them, the most common being chronic kidney disease and Cushing. We've seen fair number now of protein-losing enteropathy, so same as with protein-losing nephropathy. We suspect that there is maybe an hypercoagulability syndrome, and we've seen a couple more of heart disease as cause of ischemic stroke. So, if you got a dog with confirmed or suspected ischemic stroke, what should you look for? It's important to check the animal for heart disease, hypertension, and if you identified hypertension, look for underlying cause, but be very careful not to rely on only one measurement, repeat it over 24 hours. Look for endocrine disease, diabetes, phacromocytoma, hyperadenocorticism, hypothyroidism. Look for chronic kidney disease, including protein-losing nephropathy. And if you got hypoalbuminemia, look as well, unless there's chronic kidney disease, for protein-losing enteropathy. This is the diagnostic workup that we will perform when we identify an ischemic stroke, which is mostly blood test, urine analysis. We routinely do antithrombin-3 and D-dimer. We are not fortunate to have access for thromboelastography, but that is probably the best test to look for hypercoagulability syndrome. And depending on the result of the initial blood test, we look for hyperadenocorticism, hypothyroidism, do chest X-ray, abdo ultrasound, and heart investigation as well. The second type of cerebrovascular accident that is seen in dog, cat, and human is the hemorrhagic stroke. And as I mentioned to you, is the consequence of a rupture of a blood vessel. This bleed could occur either within the brain parenchyma or within the subarachnoid space. In human, the rupture of aneurysm is the most common cause of intracranial hemorrhage of non-traumatic origin, which in dog is exceptional. To my knowledge, there have been only a couple of cases published, but it's not really something that we will put at the top of our list of differential. In human, a very common predisposing factor for intracranial hemorrhage is primary hypertension, which is extremely rare. But in dog, the kind of underlying cause for non-traumatic brain hemorrhage is vascular malformation. So it could be arteriovenous malformation. Again, aneurysm, very, very rare. Most commonly, bleed from a primary or metastatic brain tumor. So the metastatic brain tumor we'll have in mind is hemangiosarcoma, but could is actually a common cause of hemorrhage due to a tumor. Vasculitis is maybe less common. Coagulopathy, if you live in country where angiosangulus is quite common, it is definitely something we will look for. When we've got evidence of brain hemorrhage, we look for angiosangulus. Overcause would be obviously if you got access to anticoagulant, especially rat poisoning. And finally, maybe a less common cause would be infarct can have secondary bleed when there is reperfusion. In cat, the most common cause of brain hemorrhage is far high systemic hypertension, especially in older cat with kidney disease, hyperthyroidism, or heart disease. The other causes on this slide are far less common in cat. If you have systemic hypertension, it is also very common for this cat to have not only intracranial hemorrhage, but also to have other signs of hemorrhage, especially of the retina, and that could manifest as retinal bleed and retinal detachment as well. So remember always in CAT to check the back of the eye and also to check the blood pressure, as it's a very common cause. How do we diagnose intracranial hemorrhage? Well, in that case, CT is usually very sensitive for detecting intracranial bleed, showing as hyperdensity due to the globin portion of the hemoglobin affecting the X-ray beam. So definitely, it's quick to perform a CT. It is also, in terms of anesthesia, less dangerous because it's very quick to perform and cheaper. If you have access to MRI, MRI is a fairly sensitive test, but it may not be very specific. The reason is that the MRI signal of brain hemorrhage depend a lot on when the hemorrhage started, which is very difficult to know when you got a dog or a cat presented to you. And therefore, you will have to rely on the table like that to try to see if it's consistent or not with one of the signal that is the byproduct of the oxidation of hemoglobin. So, for example, if you have a dog presented with T1 hyperintensity and T2 hyperintensity, that would be consistent with methemoglobin. And in the context of a dog with acute onset or forebrain sign, it is very likely to be a brain hemorrhage. If you're familiar with MRI, one sequence has helped to increase the specificity of the MRI finding. This sequence is the T2 star gradient echo. And you see here how useful it is to detect brain hemorrhage. On T1, you can barely see any changes, while on the T2, you got non-specific hypo and hyperintensity, while on the gradient echo, typically, you've got total signal loss. And that, again, in the context of a dog with acute onset of brain sign, is strongly suggestive of a bleed. So, what kind of condition to look for in case of hemorrhagic stroke, whether or not you suspect or confirm? Always look for a coagulopathy. So, I will routinely do PT, APTT, and looking at the platelet count. But if you identified a coagulopathy, always look for an underlying cause. So common cause, obviously, rat poisoning, hemophilia, which is not very common, but in the UK at least, we look for Aureus angelus. Other cause will be looking for a tumor, especially metastatic tumor, and hemangiosarcoma has shown you got a cranial mid-abdominal mass there. That would be something definitely to look for. Also, it could be bleeding from a primary brain tumor. And finally, especially in CAT, look for hypertension and underlying cause. So this is the diagnostic workup we will do. Blood pressure measurement, CBC, serum biochemistry, clotting time, so PT-APTT, BMBT, looking at the platelet with the CBC, obviously, thoracic X-ray to look for metastatic disease and also signs suggestive of Aureus angelus, abdo ultrasound to look for splenic mass, and fecal analysis to look for larvae of Aureus angelus or the SNAP test for Aureus angelus vasorum. What is the treatment of ischemic stroke? Well, it is mostly supportive care. And that is essentially nursing care, supporting the animal. Remember that if he's severely disabled, he won't be able to maintain his fluid requirements, so fluid therapy will be important, preventing decubital ulcer if the animal is recumbent. In terms of ischemic stroke, if you go in a little bit more detail, in theory, that is the three type of treatment. Addressing the ABC, but usually most patients can maintain their airway. Unless there is a brainstem infarct, there is usually no issue with ventilation. Blood pressure is important to check, as if the animal is severely hypertensive, you may need to address that. In terms of circulation, there is usually no issue in terms of hypovolemia with this patient. In terms of step two and step three, well, trying to find the drug that will limit the damage to the neuron is still the holy grail. And there are still billions of, or I would say millions of dollars spent, on research to try to prevent the damage to the neuron when there's a lack of blood supply. Some, drugs are show very promising results in vitro or in animal experiment, but when tested in clinical setting, unfortunately, this magic drug has still not been found. And in human, the only drug that is used is RTPA, which is recombinant tissue plasminogen activator. But this drug is only used if you diagnose an ischemic stroke within the first 3 hours, which will be never, it will never happen, but the dog will be go through a referral and an MRI within 3 hours. The main drawback of using RTPA in human is that 10% of these patients receiving RTPA for thrombolysis may suffer significant brain hemorrhage. In dog, as we're going to see, we may use low-dose aspirin or Fragmin not to as thrombolytic therapy, but to prevent relapse, especially if you got evidence of hypercoagulability syndrome. So, for example, I will use it on the dog with protein-losing enteropathy or protein-losing nephropathy. As I say, in terms of ABC, it's usually not an issue. Main issue is to monitor the blood pressure. And if you've got a cat with severe hypertension, the first step is to restore normal blood pressure. We've discussed about RTPA. I will only use antiplatelet drug in basically dog. I will use that if you got evidence of protein-losing enteropathy or nephropathy. Fragmin is not a drug that I will use frequently, in these dogs. So most of the time, the management of ischemic stroke is nursing care. Most dogs will recover usually within 2 to 3 weeks. That's when I will expect them to recover. Unfortunately, there is no guarantee, and it's a matter of giving time. In terms of hemorrhagic stroke, again, you need to look for underlying cause and address it. So if you find Ansa-Schangelius, treat it. If you find evidence of hypertension, you need to treat that. In terms of treating the hemorrhage itself, then it's the same management of head trauma. You need to make sure that the animal is oxygenating, not hypoventilating, not hypovolemic. If the animal has a deteriorating neurological status and you know he's got intracranial hemorrhage, then you need to try to stabilize him in terms of giving drug to try to reduce the edema and improve the blood perfusion. And in that case, despite what you may have been taught in the past, it is totally indicated to use mannitol on this dog in order to improve the cerebral blood flow and also improve the raised intracranial pressure that could be seen with severe brain hemorrhage. If you got a dog like this one with an hemorrhage between the skull and the brain with a deteriorating neurological status, then that's a rare scenario where decompressive craniectomy will be indicated. Prognosis is usually good, but depends very much on underlying cause. And if you got an underlying cause, an underlying sinister cause, obviously that will affect the outcome. But otherwise, most dog or cat with stroke tend to make good improvement within 2 to 3 weeks, which can give you a guide as to how long to give them to give a prognosis to the owner. Next topic is inflammatory CNS disease, and I will briefly discuss the two types that we see, GME and the breast-specific meningoencephalitis. But you need to know from the start that, except a rare number of cases, it is very difficult to know, even with MRI, if we're dealing with one or the other. And that's the reason why they are usually described as meningoencephalitis of unknown etiology. GME is probably the most well-known and the most well-studied inflammation of the brain. It is seen in many breeds, but predisposition in Toyo and Terrier breed of dog. The age of onset could be any time from 9 months to 10 years, but in our experience, it's mostly young adult, middle-aged dog. And what you need to do about this disease is that it is a disease that is mostly centered around the blood vessel. And it's mostly affecting the blood vessel in the white matter. So it is important to know, because from an imaging point of view, it may be a clue to help you to recognize that we're dealing with GME as opposed to another type of disease. Inflammation of the leptomeninges is also common, which may be a way for you to diagnose an inflammatory disease by collecting the CSF, which will be in contact with this inflamed leptomeninges. There are different clinical forms of GME. The one that we see most commonly is the multifocal form, and therefore the animal will show multifocal neurological signs. Less common form is the focal form, and it usually have a more insidious onset as opposed to the multifocal one that have a fairly rapid onset. This focal form poses a problem because from a clinical point of view, but also from an imaging point of view, it can be difficult to distinguish from a neoplasia. And finally, there is an ocular form centered mostly to the optic nerves, also known as optic neuritis. This optic neuritis is a common cause of blindness and can be sometimes diagnosed by looking at the fundus, where you may be able to see these typical changes suggestive of optic neuritis, where the arteries in the retina won't be in focus and you got swelling of the optic nerve. What do we know about the cause of GME? Well, many causes have been advocated in the past. Is it a pre-neoplastic condition? Is it due to an infection? So far, there have been no solid proof for either of these two hypotheses. And at the moment, the consensus is that we are dealing with an autoimmune disease. What we don't know, unfortunately, is what is the trigger of this aberrant reaction of the immune system. There is certainly some genetic component that must play a role, considering that some breeds are more prone than others to develop this condition. In terms of diagnosis, GME can in theory only be diagnosed at postmortem, but with a diagnostic test, you may get a strong index of suspicion. With MRI, first of all, you may get a strong index of suspicion if you got multifocal lesion, as you can see on this scan here, and the lesions are mostly affecting the gray matter. So you got the ventricle here, multifocal lesion here within the gray matter. That would be, again, in favor of granulomatous meningoencephalitis. Another type of case here, where we've used an MRI sequence called the FLAIR, which suppresses the signal from free water, like the one you find in the ventricle, which help to highlight white matter lesion, which is in close contact with the ventricles. And you can see multifocal lesion there, mostly in the white matter, again, that is strongly suspicious of GME. The other inflammatory disease that we see commonly is the breed-specific meningoencephalitis. So they differ from GME mostly by their lesion distribution, but also in terms of severity, they have a far worse prognosis. Two types of breed-specific meningoencephalitis are described, the necrotizing meningoencephalitis, or NME, and the necrotizing leukoencephalitis, or NLE. And some breeds are more prone to one than the other. But be mindful that there is, unfortunately, overlap, so you can't really make a diagnosis purely on the breed. The same way, some of these breeds, for example, Yorkshire Terrier, or even pug could also be affected by GME. So don't think if you got a pug with multifocal brain signs that he must have necrotizing meningoencephalitis, which used to be called pug dog encephalitis. It could also be a GME as well. What you need to do about NME? It is a disease that initially was described in pugs and given the name pug dog encephalitis. Other breeds have been described: Maltese, Shih Tzu, Papillon, Chihuahua. In terms of etiology, like GME, it is suspected to be an autoimmune disease with a strong genetic component to that, considering that some family of pugs are more prone than others. In terms of neurological sign, these dogs with NME tend to have mostly forebrain signs, and in that case, seizures would be usually very common and could have isolated seizures with no neurological sign for a few weeks until they start developing other forebrain signs circling visual deficit. Brainstem signs are less common. Unfortunately, the course of the disease is often fatal within a few weeks to a few months despite therapy. So not a great disease, I'm afraid. In terms of histopathology, which may help you to recognize it with MRI, NME tend to affect both the white and the gray matter. It is a pound encephalitis, so gray and white matter, while GME is mostly white matter, and it affects as well the leptomeninges. NLE, or necrotizing leukoencephalitis, is another breed-specific encephalitis. In that case, the neurological signs are often brainstem signs, so central vestibular sign would be frequent initial sign, plus or minus forebrain signs. It is common in Yorkshire Terrier, but we've seen other breed could be affected. In terms of histopathology, it is mostly affecting the subcortical white matter, as shown on this slide, and very often cause cavitary lesion, which can be seen in some dog on MRI and help you to make a presumptive diagnosis of NLE. So, having seen these different encephalitis, how do we diagnose them? Obviously, the signal mount may be helpful, but remember there is crossover. In terms of extraneural signs, some of these dogs may be pyrexic, but it's not an exclusive criteria. So you could have a dog totally normothermic. In terms of blood profile, it is a misconception to think that dog with severe encephalitis will have neutrophilia and leukocytosis. They could have as well totally normal blood. In terms of CSF analysis, most of these dogs will have changes within the CSF, especially pure mononuclear pleocytosis or mixed one, especially with a necrotizing form. But be mindful that a normal CSF doesn't help you, doesn't mean that you can rule out an encephalitis. In terms of diagnostic imaging, sometimes, as we've seen, the lesion distribution could help you to suspect GME versus leukoencephalitis or necrotizing meningoencephalitis, but sometimes it's not so black and white. And really, at the end, only histopathology can help you to make a definitive diagnosis, which is not something we perform routinely. So overall, we give to this condition the umbrella term of meningoencephalitis of unknown etiology. It is very important when you face with a dog with suspected encephalitis, especially multifocal signs, to make sure you rule out infectious cause, because the diagnosis of an immune-mediated cause can only be made by exclusion of other mimic, which in that case would be infectious cause. So depending where you live, you need to test the animal for common infectious etiology. So in the UK, we'll do serology and PCR for distemper, toxo and neospora. But depending where you live in the world, you may need to adapt this infectious profile to what is endemic in your region. What is the prognosis of all this inflammatory disease? Well, again, dog with the necrotizing form or the breed specific, the pug dog encephalitis, usually don't do well, and within a few weeks to a few months they will ultimately succumb of the disease. But we never know in advance what is the prognosis, and most of the dog we call them meningoencephalitis of unknown etiology. The way I try to explain to my pet owner what is the prognosis is that roughly one third of dog will do well, and doing well mean that with time, many months of treatment, the dog will return to normal and you'll be able to wean him off medication and he will not relapse. One third of dog, you basically will manage to make them back to normal, wean them off, but you won't manage to take them off medication, and they will require low dose of immunosuppressive drug as a lifelong treatment. And one third of dog, whatever you're going to give them, they will not respond, or they will initially respond and then relapse when you wean him off. And the treatment is very much like a race. Initially, you need to hit them hard with high doses of immunosuppressive drug, and I will come back to that. But as you know, if you use this immunosuppressive drug at high dose for too long period of time, then you're going to have issue with side effect of this medication. So you're going to have to reduce the pace after getting ahead of the disease. So initially you try to have return to normal at high dose, then you slowly reduce the pace or slowly reduce the dosage to try to always be ahead of the disease. And in some dog, the disease will run out of breath and you'll be able to take them off medication. In some dog, you will always manage to be just ahead, but if you reduce further, they relapse. And in some dog, unfortunately, the disease will take over. So you have to adapt the treatment to each individual. The standard treatment I tend to use is a combination of prednisolone, starting at 1 to 2 mg per kg BID for 2 weeks, and then decrease very slowly every 4 weeks, keeping the dog for at least 6 months on treatment, to which I will add one of these immunosuppressive drugs. And all of them can be potentially used in addition to prednisolone. My standard of care is using cytosine arabinoside or cytarabine. I will use other drugs, cyclosporine or procarbazine, in cases that relapse when I start reducing either prednisolone or cytarabine. But I personally always use multi-drug therapy as opposed to steroid alone. So cytosine arabinoside, I use a subcutaneous injection, 50 mg per meter square, given 4 doses within 2 consecutive days, initially every 3 weeks, and I do it 4 times, then every 4 weeks, then every 5 weeks, then every 6 weeks. One of the main side effects is myelosuppression, which is extremely rare, but to try to palliate that, I always do CBC before giving each cycle of 4 injections. I use cyclosporine in cases where the dog initially responds, but when I start reducing prednisolone and or cytarabine, they start to relapse, then I will add cyclosporine to the treatment, so using 3 drugs. The dosage I use is anywhere between 5 to 10 mg per kick BID, in addition to prednisolone and cytarabine. So it's my rescue treatment. How do we follow up treatment? Well, obviously, the first thing is to go with clinical remission. And if the animal has responded well, I usually ask the owner to come back at 3 months, do a full neuro exam. If it's normal, I repeat MRI and CSF and adapt the treatment to the need. So if there is still either MRI or CSF abnormality, I will continue the treatment for another 6 months and then try to reduce further. If not, if it's completely normal, I will try to take the animal off medication over 3 months and monitor the clinical signs. The last topic we're going to discuss is brain tumor, and that again is a fairly common brain disease. Three types of brain tumor: primary brain tumor, so tumor arising from the brain cells or the lining of the brain, like the meninges, and on the top you got a beautiful example of a meningioma. Underneath you got an example of a glioma. Secondary brain tumor are basically tumor arising in the vicinity of the brain, and it could be, for example, calvarial tumor, so bone tumor or sarcoma. It could be also tumor arising from the soft tissue around the head that invades secondary the calvarium as well. And finally, the last type of brain tumor is metastasis, and you got a beautiful example underneath from an hemangiosarcoma. What you need to know about brain tumor is that the neurological signs are usually due either to the tumor invading the brain or pressing on the brain and affecting, you know, the vital parts that are necessary for a dog or a cat to be a dog and a cat. So, for example, it could be, if you're dealing with a brainstem tumor, you may have central vestibular signs. If it's in the forebrain, you may have vision loss. Other cause for the clinical sign will be that as the tumor grows, it's going to affect the ability of the brain to maintain a normal intracranial pressure. And when all the compensatory mechanisms are exhausted, then you're going to have sudden rise in intracranial pressure, leading to fairly diffuse forebrain signs or brainstem signs. Other less common mechanism to explain neurological signs are tumor can seed to other part of the nervous system, causing multifocal sign, and finally, very rarely, you may have paraneoplastic effect. Most brain tumors tend to affect the pressure within the calvarium. And the reason for that is that initially the brain is able to compensate any increase in volume of a pathology like a tumor. But there will be a point where the intracranial pressure will suddenly rise when all these compensatory mechanisms are exhausted, leading to a fairly rapid onset of neurological signs. So it is fairly common that when we diagnose brain tumor in dog and cat, they have usually evolved for fairly long time, especially forebrain. I'm afraid to say most cat and dog do not use their forebrain to be cat and dog, and therefore pathology like tumor can grow there undetected for long period of time until a point where the tumor is big enough to affect this compensatory mechanism of intracranial pressure and will suddenly cause rise in intracranial pressure. If you're not familiar with Monokelly doctrine, that is basically the basis for this compensatory mechanism in ICP. The way the brain compensates that is initially by shifting CSF out of the intracranial cavity, decreasing the production and increasing the absorption. Following that, the way the brain compensates is basically by decreasing the volume of venous blood. And finally, the last way will be to decrease the amount of arterial blood. But unfortunately, by doing so, this creates more edema and therefore exaggerate the volume of the pathology and the intracranial pressure. Clinical presentation of brain tumor, they are usually seen in older dogs, more than 5 years old, but can be seen as well in very young dogs, including puppies. The onset of clinical signs is usually chronic, insidious, and progressive. But sometimes, rarely, they can be acute onset, especially if you got sudden decompensation or a bleed of a tumor. The neurological sign depends on where the tumor is. So if you got forebrain sign, you may have asymmetrical forebrain sign, lack of menace on one eye with normal PLR, circling to the affected side, a contralateral proprioceptive deficit. If it's in the brainstem, commonly you will have central vestibular or hemiparesis. Seizures is at least very common when you got forebrain tumor. How do we diagnose brain tumor? You need to have access to advanced imaging, either CT or best MRI. But remember that tumor can also arise from outside of the brain. And I think it's good practice, if you got a dog more than 9 years old, to do a metastatic check before to send this dog for an expensive MRI scan. And I will recommend to do at least chest X-ray, have a good feel at the belly, not to miss something obvious like this splenic mass. But the chest X-ray will be important to look for metastatic disease. CSF very rarely will give you an answer as to the nature of the tumor. Maybe the only exception would be lymphoma. And ultimately, with MRI, you can get only a presumptive diagnosis of a brain tumor and its nature. Ideally, the only way to have a definitive answer is a brain biopsy, which, for obvious technical reasons, is not always, you know, performed. How do we treat brain tumor? Well, two options, palliative care or treating the tumor itself. So in terms of palliative care, you're treating the symptom. If the animal is presented with seizures, then you need to put the animal on anti-epileptic drug. Now, the issue is that a lot of dogs with forebrain tumor will not respond very well to phenobarbital, especially at the usual dose. So I tend not to use phenobarbital or Pexion. I personally tend to use in this dog levetiracetam Keppra because I feel they have far less side effects. Remember, if you do palliative, you're looking at quality of life. The other advantage of levetiracetam, quick mode of action. The other type of palliative approach, in addition to seizure treatment, if they are seizuring, I give corticosteroid to reduce the edema. And that usually tend to improve a lot the dog, but it will have only a limited effect in terms of time, as the tumor will carry on growing. At some point, the pressure will rise and the animal will stop responding to prednisolone. If you got an animal in the scanner and is decompensating, you can always use under anesthesia mannitol to help him through the recovery. But remember that the mannitol will only last for a few hours. So you need to then put the animal on prednisolone. In terms of specific treatment for the tumor, there is different approach. Radiotherapy, removing the tumor surgically, or chemotherapy. The ideal way, especially in dog, is to have a multi-modality treatment. As we're going to see, depending, you know, on the case, not every case are amenable to surgery. And the kind of case that I tend to do surgery on are mostly the meningioma, especially if they are very superficial. And I use the analogy of this clock just to help you to understand which one will be accessible surgically, will be mostly the superficial tumor, meningioma in most of the case, located between 8 o'clock and 4 o'clock. Anything between 4 and 8 will not be really accessible surgically. If you do surgery, again, that takes a lot of practice, a lot of surgical planning, because when you open the skull, you need to know exactly where the tumor is and where you should make this craniectomy. That is an example of a cat, and you can see that in cat, despite the very large size of the tumor, you can usually remove the totality of the tumor, and that is on the left pre-surgery and on the right 2-month MRI check. In cat, for example, surgery alone is usually curative for meningioma, or at least provide a long-term remission of 24 to 36 months. In dog, it is not the case. I will always strongly advise, after surgery for meningioma, to do radiotherapy, because the meningioma are usually far more commonly infiltrative of the brain, while in cat they are very well encapsulated, so not really infiltrating the brain. So at the top, you got an example of a dog pre-op, at 2 months, and you can see that there is already some regrowth or tumor left, and this is 3 months after radiotherapy. While in cat, tumor is very well encapsulated. Even if it's very big, all these cats will do very well with surgery in the large majority of cases. If you got glioma, then I usually advise radiotherapy. And in terms of prognosis, glioma with radiotherapy, you may have remission anywhere between 6 to 12 months, depending obviously on the dog and how advanced is the tumor. So this is some at least idea of medium survival time in cat, as I say. With surgery alone, they usually go over 2 years, and sometimes be curative, while in dog, you need to give radiotherapy to achieve at least 18 months median survival. Glioma, as I say, radiotherapy will be the best way to treat them. Obviously, if the dog is severely affected neurologically and do not respond to palliative steroid, I will be a little bit reluctant to put him through radiotherapy. If he responds very well to prednisolone, I encourage to do radiotherapy, but the median survival is usually around 6 to 12 months before they relapse. So I hope that this presentation has been useful to you and give you some insight of common brain disease, so stroke, inflammatory disease, and neoplastic, and I'd be happy to take any further question you may have. Thank you very much. So there is question about do I use drug basically like Vivitonin for cerebrovascular accident? If I was putting basically £1 in the kitty every time this question was asked, I would be a very rich man, I would say. Yes, there is a tendency for practitioner when they suspect a stroke to give a drug. I'm afraid it is without any scientific basis. Remember, I've told you that millions of pounds or dollars are spent every year in research to try to find the holy grail, which is the drug that will prevent neuronal damage due to the lack of blood supply. And I'm afraid no drug has proven their efficacy in clinical setting. And if it was as easy as giving Vivitonin, it would be done already in human, where they diagnose stroke far earlier than us. So I'm afraid, I'm not saying don't give it, but there is no reason really to give it, and there is no proof that it would make any difference in this patient. There is a question as well about how long to treat GME. As I say, I tend to apply the same treatment initially to every dog, which is I use cytarabine. And if the dog is severely neurological, I'd give cytarabine as a continuous rate infusion, 200 milligram per meter square over 6 hours, and then give the cycle of 4 injections over 2 days subcutaneously every 3 weeks. So I do that on every single dog with prednisolone, and then at 3 months I reassess the situation. And as I explained to you, it's really important to grasp that you can't apply the same treatment to every dog. You need to adapt the treatment to the individual. And in some dog, you will manage to take them off medication within 9 to 12 months, but in others, I'm afraid you won't be able to take them off medication. So you need to keep a very close eye, reduce the medication very slowly. If they are neurologically normal, the way to guide you is really the clinical sign. If they are neurologically normal, then before I try to take them off medication, I repeat the scan. And I do serial MRI every 6 months on this patient, really, to try to gather as much information as I can to know how safe it is to reduce. But nothing is black and white, I'm afraid. I don't think there's any more question. So I just wanted to thank you very much for your attention, and hope to see you again soon for another Neurology Webinar Club. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Laurent for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.